So tonight I'm continuing with this process of what I've been calling deconstructing the Satipatthana Sutta. This is week four of this. Tonight I want to talk about something called the refrain. And in the Satipatthana Sutta, there is this repeated set of instructions that come after each of the 13 sets of construction. So this refrain is repeated 13 times. And it always struck me when I first found that out that, like, oh, this must be important if the Buddha keeps repeating it. And I dug into it somewhat before this, and now I'm dug in a little deeper still. And it's quite interesting. And so I have a whole variety of interesting things to say. And the first six times, so the last 2 weeks, we talked about these six sets of instructions on mindfulness of body. And so this particular thing is repeated after each of those things on mindfulness of body, and then later on through the other teachings. Here's the actual words. In this way, he abides contemplating the body as a body internally, or he abides contemplating the body as a body externally, or he abides contemplating the body as a body both internally or externally. Or else he abides contemplating in the body its nature of arising, or he abides contemplating in the body its nature of vanishing. Or he abides contemplating in the nature of its both arising and vanishing. Or else, mindfulness that there is a body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. This is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body. Pretty dense language. And the key thing here, and how this, I've sort of broken down this talk, and how I've always heard this talked about, is there are actually four different things he's saying here. He's talking about this idea of knowing, abiding knowing the body both internally and externally, abiding knowing that the body arises and passes away, or both. That we notice that there is a body to the extent necessary. And then if you can do that, you abide independent, not clinging to anything. So these are four things. And how I've come to think of this refrain, and really what I want to talk about for the rest of the evening, is that this set of instructions is basically instructions on how to deepen your practice of the instructions that just came before it. So there's like mindfulness of breath, and then, well, here's a way to deepen that practice. And so each of these additional instructions are skillful means to deepen the practice of mindfulness of body in various ways, depending on, which one you're looking at. So the first one is internally and externally. He says, first of all, I want to mention, he said, the word here is abides. Abides is like a common word in the sutta in many places, and it always connotes to me, you abide in your abode, right? This is where you live. This is like central. It's not like sort of some casual thing. It's like where you live. It's central to you, who you are, or how you're practicing. So, internally and externally, this first pair. And what I experience in my body and in other people's bodies, right? And the idea of internal is pretty obvious, because a lot of what we do, especially when we're practicing, is we're paying attention to body sensation, to our experience of having a body. the twinge in my knee, and then my nose itches, and then I can feel that breath, and then my butt's getting tired because I've been sitting on this hard thing too long, and so on. We pay a lot of so internally in this body. But what about externally? What does he mean here when he says externally? And the first one, and now we're going to shift to analeo in a minute. But the first one I think is kind of obvious. And that's that if you're ever sitting with other people, if you ever sat in, in a group, it's pretty easy if you're not careful to get annoyed by the people who are coughing or shuffling in their seat or, breathing really loud. I had a person used to, I sat next to once who breathed really loudly. I don't know if it was intentional or not, but it was like this steam engine next to me in the hall. But what happens in all these cases is we think that person's disturbing my practice. Right? That's where we go. It's like we get a little self-righteous about it sometimes, even if we're not careful. And what the Buddha is pointing to here is you can notice that. You could note that loud breathing or that coughing or that whatever, that shuffling. That's just another thing to note. It's just we don't have to just note what's going on in this body, this what we perceive of, what we think of as my body, but all those other bodies all around you, they're just equally valid in terms of what you could pay attention to. So someone coughs and you note coughing. Or you might notice annoyance, your own annoyance, and then or whatever. But it's just something that's happening, and this points really directly to the idea that we somehow get this idea that we have to have perfect conditions for practice, right? It's got to be quiet. It's got to be no one's going to disturb me, and so on and so on. And I had a friend once who, when she would sit, she'd put on a face mask and put earplugs in. Like, so she wouldn't be disturbed by all those other people around her and stuff. And I'm sure her mind was just worrying, so she was being disturbed by other things all the time anyway. But it's like, she was trying to shut out the world. And instead, what the Buddha is saying here is just, what's going on out there is just as valid as something to pay attention to, something to notice. If that's what's catching your attention, notice it. Be aware of it. Within the classical noting system, note it. Perfectly valid thing to do. Analeo had some other interesting things to say here. And this is also, I think, quite valid. Thus, external satipatthana can be undertaken by directing awareness toward another person's posture, facial expressions, and tone of voice as indicators of their feelings or state of mind. Understanding external awareness of another in this way would, to some extent, resemble the way a psychoanalyst observes a patient, closely examining behavior and related symptoms in order to assess their state of mind. Thus, an external application of awareness would be a practice particularly suitable in daily life, since most of the phenomena to be observed will not occur when one is seated in a formal meditation. So what he's saying is, oh, this idea of external points very directly to the idea of mindfulness in daily life. That mindfulness isn't just sitting, isn't practice just sitting. And if you can be actually mindful of what other people are, the subtle things, the little twitches and signs and the way they pause before they say something, all these little things, it can really help you tune into them and then hopefully Be kinder. Be more helpful without being, without being so reactive. You can see, oh, maybe this, people talk about always telling the truth, but and they justify blurting things out to people. So, well, it's the truth, right? But if you sort of tune into somebody and you see there where they're at, you might go, maybe I should tell them that later. I don't, even though it's absolutely true, maybe they're not in a condition to absorb something like that right now. It's a little judgmental, perhaps, but it's like tuning into people allows you to be more skillful in your relationships with them. This is mindfulness in action in our daily lives in the world. That's because we're being mindful externally as opposed to internally. So that's one thing. Then Analeo has another interesting thing to say here. And for a balanced development of awareness, this shift from the internal to the external is of considerable importance. Awareness applied only internally can lead to self-centeredness. One can become excessively concerned with what happens and within oneself, while at the same time remaining unaware of how one's actions and behavior affect others. Practicing both internal and external satipatthana can prevent such lopsidedness and achieve a skillful balance between introversion and extroversion. So once again, he's pointing to the value of being mindful in terms of how you relate to other people. I think this is interesting when you think of it in this context. It's like, oh, the Buddha wasn't just talking about sitting, cross-legged under a tree. He was also very much talking about being aware of what's going on around you so that you can act with loving kindness more easily to the people around you. Seems like something useful, right? Joseph also had some interesting things to say here. If I can get the book off my desk. There we go. He says two kind of interesting things, I think, actually. Being body of the mind, being mindful of the body externally has another advantage. Have you noticed when you're mindful of someone else moving very carefully without distraction, then you yourself become more concentrated? Just seeing someone walking very slowly, you become more concentrated. This is one reason the Buddha suggested that we associate with those who are mindful and concentrated. It's contagious. In this way, our own practice becomes a real offering to our fellow practitioners. I see this all the time when I teach groups of people. If the group is sort of a little twittery, the whole thing gets twittery. But if people are If they have some people there who are really calm and still and steady and settled, it affects the people around them. And both in sitting practice and in walking practice as well. When you see people walking very slowly, then you sort of tune into that energy and you start to emulate it because you don't want to disturb them. And it's totally unconscious, I think. But people tune into the vibe of what's going on in the room. And it really affects them. That's one thing Joseph has to say. This is another thing which I also thought was interesting. And he's talking about, in the instruction it says, notice the body internally, notice the body externally, notice the body both internally and externally. What's going on here? And I think the idea here is the Buddha's pointing to the ideas behind what's called open awareness, of not rejecting anything. Whatever's there, doesn't matter what it is. There you are in some quiet place in the forest and it's so still. And then, the wind blows and the leaves start rattling. And if you're not careful, it disturbs you, or whatever. So whatever is there in the environment is all equally important, equally worthy of paying attention to. And the idea of open awareness is that whatever's there, really, we're not being at all selective. We're just noting what arises that catches our attention. And then Joseph has this other thing to say, which I think is also interesting. The last part of this instruction is to contemplate both internally and externally. And Leo suggests that this is not just a simple repetition, but rather reflects a more profound understanding that we should contemplate experience without considering it to be part of one's own experience or that of another, but just as an objective experience in itself. Being mindful internally, externally, and both reminds us of the comprehensive nature of mindfulness practice, to be aware of whatever is there, whether it's within us or without, and in the end, to go beyond this division altogether. Notice things internally, notice things externally. But then, if you notice them both internally and externally, you're starting to break down this me, not me sense, because it's just stuff. I'm just experiencing stuff, which is impersonal. It's just stuff that's happening. And I'm noticing it. Well, it's being noticed. I don't have even say I notice it. It's like it's being noticed. It's being noted. It's a shift in how we think about me, not me. My body. Because part of the thing about mindfulness of the body is that if we're not careful, we get really fixated on my body, not my body. And the internally, externally, simultaneously breaks that down in a sense, which I think is just worth thinking about at least. Okay. Then we come to the arising and passing away. Which is the next set of instructions. And basically, what the Buddha is pointing to here is if you're paying attention to the arising and the passing away, or both the arising and passing away, what you're starting to do is you're paying attention not to the thing itself, but its nature. You're looking underneath the experience to see the impermanent nature of everything you're experiencing. And in a sense, he's pointing to actually pay attention and note the impermanence itself, as opposed to the actual experience. Like the actual experience, like there's a layer of actual experience, and we do, he's pointing to the idea of maybe we don't want to get so fixated on that layer. We want to be aware of that, but at the same time, can we be aware of the functioning that's happening underneath that layer, which is just things are arising and passing away. That everything, there's nothing that we experience when we're paying attention that is permanent. That everything that we see arising passes away. We start to see the impermanence of things. Analeo has some things to say about this, of course. The refrain instructs the meditator to contemplate the nature of arising, the nature of passing away, and the nature of both arising and passing away. Paralleling the instruction on internal and external contemplation, The three parts of this instruction represent a temporal progression which leads from observing the arising aspect of phenomena to focusing on their disappearance and culminating in a comprehensive vision of impermanence as such. This is a philosophy PhD, so it's pretty dense language sometimes. According to the discourses, not seeing the arising and passing away of phenomena is simply ignorance. Well, simply stated, right? Well, to regard all phenomena as impermanent leads to knowledge and understanding. Insight into impermanence of the five aggregates or the six sense spheres is right view, and thereby leads directly to realization. Thus, the direct experience of impermanence represents indeed the power aspect of meditative wisdom. These passages clearly show the central importance of developing a direct experience of impermanent nature of all phenomena, as envisioned in this part of the Satipatthana refrain. The same is reflected in the commentarial schemes on the insight knowledges, which detail key experiences to be encountered during the path of realization, where the stage of apprehending the arising and passing away of phenomena is of central importance. So, there we are. We're just learning how to pay attention to our breath, we think. But what we're really also learning to pay attention to is the fact that our breath arises, then it passes away. Or in a broader sense, with body sensation, a body sense arises. It's there for a while, and then it's gone. And that's what we're paying attention to. It's the process as opposed to the phenomena themselves that we start paying attention to. So that's one layer of this. Another layer is clearly knowing, experiencing that everything is impermanent leads to knowledge of unsatisfactoriness and non-self. Once we experience impermanence, as not as a theoretical idea, but as we actually see it and experience it, then how could we be satisfied with anything? How, you know, which unsatisfactory doesn't mean it's like it's bad. It's just that there's nothing there. There's no there there. So it's unsatisfactory in the sense of unsatisfactoriness is a translation of dukkha, of the word dukkha, that often is translated as suffering, right? But I like the translation unsatisfactoriness instead, because it's saying, it's not that it's bad, it's just that it doesn't work in terms of making me really happy. Because it's always, whatever arises and makes me happy, it's gonna go away, guaranteed. Just like that, it's gonna be gone. So how can I possibly think anything in the phenomenal world, anything that arises, could possibly be a source of happiness? It's interesting. And then that leads directly to the experience of not self. Because, oh wait, if there's nothing there that makes me happy, then we start to see there's no me there. It's just stuff arising and passing away. Just this constant flow of things arising and passing away. Another interesting tidbit here. When in the instructions, we're instructed first to arise, to become aware of things arising. Because seeing things arising, if we're actually paying attention and noting, it's much easier to see something arising than to see something passing away. Because arising is like there's something happening. You know, passing away is almost like a negative. You know, you don't notice something's passed away till it's passed away. And I've actually, on one a retreat I was on recently, a teacher was talking about this, and he said, no, if you want to really start to work on paying attention to this part of the Satipatthana Sutta instructions. Just start by sort of forming the intention to see things arising. Forget about passing away to start with. Just can you notice things arising? And then after a while, you'll start sort of like twig into, oh, wait, I noticed that arise, and now it's gone. And the fact that it's gone means you're noting that it has passed away. You may not see it passing away, but you'll know that it has passed away. You'll notice that. And that's the beginning of the second part. It's an interesting idea that we can sort of play with a little bit. Joseph Goldstein had something else to say about this, of course. And he's talking about this idea of how seeing impermanence leads to a deeper, complete understanding of the three attributes, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not-self. And he's talking about, somehow it just happens that we come to that place. How does this happen? What is the liberating power of this teaching? When we see deeply that all that is subject to arising is also subject to cessation, that whatever arises will also pass away, the mind becomes disenchanted. I like that word, disenchanted. Becoming disenchanted, one becomes dispassionate. And through dispassion, the mind is liberated. It's telling that the English word disenchanted, disillusioned, and dispassionate often have negative connotations. But looking more closely at their meaning reveals their connection to freedom. Becoming disenchanted means breaking the spell of enchantment. We're under the spell that things are permanent, that things aren't going to last. That's a spell that we're under. And when we become disenchanted, it's like, oh, thank goodness. It's not a bad thing at all. It's like, oh, thank goodness I'm disenchanted. Right? Waking up into a fuller and greater reality. It is the happy ending of so many great myths and fairy tales. Disillusion is not the same as being discouraged or disappointed. It's a recognition with what is free, true, free of illusion. And dispassionate doesn't mean indifferent or apathetic. Rather, it is the mind of great openness and equanimity, free of grasping. Language and how we interpret language, huh? And how we see these, we see the dis in front of words, and it's like, oh, that's bad. It's just like my reaction until I read this. I'm like, oh yeah, look, here's all these dis words that we usually take as not good, and like they're actually pointing to really important parts of awakening, of waking up. Then we come to this really interesting section, I think. Or else mindfulness that there is a body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. So here we are being mindful of body, and we have to be careful. So I have some notes, and this is a lot of these are from my own personal experience, these notes actually. With all of my instructions on mindfulness of body, it's easy to get lost in the focus on the particular. Like this, you become obsessed. I've got to see everything that's happening in my body. I gotta be aware of every sensation. I can't miss any of them. It becomes like this obsessive mind state that, of course, leads to disappointment because you can't possibly notice everything. You're having 20 sensations a second for a start, right? So unless your mind works really, really fast, you're never going to see everything anyway. And so this phrase about there is a body reminds us to sort of step back and sort of take in the whole experience. It's really interesting to sort of be able to make this shift. And sometimes I shift back and forth actually when I'm practicing, where at some points I'm being quite particular because I need to sort of get more concentrated. But when my concentration is flowing, then I sort of step back and just tune into, oh, all those sensations I'm experiencing right now, when I put them all together, there is the body. That's all. It's not like it's just that there is a body. There's no, it's not like a big deal. It's just, oh, that sense of me, of there being a body is just made up of all of these separate bits of sensation, and I keep putting them all together sort of automatically as I cognize things and put it all together and say there is a body there. That's what mind does. And sometimes you can sort of step back and tune in at that level and not be so fixated on the details. And this is also interesting. The body is real. Here's the tricky part. The body's real. And when I say that, I'm sure the alarm bells might be going, like, no, but the body's not real. And you see that stated. So the body's real even though it's impermanent. It never stops changing, even for a moment. You know, me sitting here talking and you listening, we've all had tens of thousands of cells die and new cells grow. While we're sitting there, changing all the time. It never stops. So, how can we, and here I'm back to that idea of relative reality and absolute reality, you know, that I talked about last week. How do we deal with this? Because it's pretty hard to deny there's a body here. You know, this, yep, sure enough, I can feel it. There's a body here for sure. But if I'm not careful, I get fixated and make it permanent. So how can we think about this? And my teacher Guy used this great sentence, and I want to read this sentence to you. But it is this ever-changing stream of physical and mental phenomena, conventionally known as Barry, that is what I think of as self. I'll read that again. But it is this ever-changing stream of physical and mental phenomena, conventionally known as Barry, that is what I think of as self. So as long as I'm aware that things are constantly changing all the time, it's not a big deal. Like I can still have a body, even though I have to be aware of its nature. Very clearly aware that of its constantly changing nature, its impermanent nature all the time. And that that label Barry just happens to be conventionally stuck on it, because when I got born, someone stuck it on me. Right? And so as long as I don't think it's permanent and unchanging, this not a, this idea of a self in this sense is not problematic. It's a way to sort of acknowledge that, yeah, I have to function in the world. And if, when someone says Barry, I'd better respond. That's all. Can I be okay with that level of body, of self? Another thing, Note that the phrase itself is, there is a body. So it's not like I'm being aware I have a body, or this is my body. All I'm trying to be aware of is the the language points to that fact that there's a body there. Sure enough, put all those physical experiences together, mental experiences together, and there's a body there. But it isn't mine, it isn't anything other than that's what's there. It's like the collective image view of what I'm experiencing. There is a body. Period. Then there's this phrase, to the extent necessary. I'll read this again. Or else mindfulness that there is a body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. To the extent necessary. So here the Buddha is pointing very directly to the middle path. The idea that if we're not careful, we strive too much. Like, I'm gonna see every physical sensation without missing one, and I'm gonna just be able to do this forever. I'm gonna be perfect, right? I'm gonna be the perfect meditator. And this just ends up where we end up feeling like a failure because we can't. We can't note everything, and we're constantly judging our practice. And we become tense. And meditation, the actual process of meditation, works much better when we're relaxed. When I can be okay with the fact that I'm doing the best I can, and I'm noting what I see, and I'm tuning into things, and I'm not getting caught in the emotional storms that arise when certain things arise. Great. Doing fine. Without becoming too laid back and going, no sense making any effort. I know I'm in my true essence perfect anyway. So why should I make any effort at all? That's the other extreme, right? Somewhere in the middle, to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. Bare knowledge being just enough without any story process arising from what I'm experiencing. I experience the actual thing, and then I'm not thinking about it or fantasizing about it or extrapolating it or interpolating it or doing any of those things the mind does so well. I'm just paying attention. That's all. To the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And then this last sentence is also quite interesting. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. And both Analeo and Joseph have things to say about that sentence. I'll show you Analeo's first. And he's talking about what happens if our knowledge of the Buddha's teachings are purely theoretical. Like, we're just like, we got the sutta down, we can quote a chapter and verse, right? The inability of a purely theoretical approach to result in awakening is a recurrent theme in the discourses. Spend one's time intellectually considering the Dhamma and thereby neglecting actual practice clearly meets the Buddha's disapproval. According to him, one who acts thus cannot be considered a practitioner of the Dhamma, but merely someone who is caught up in thinking. Sati is such as such is mere awareness of phenomena without letting the mind stray into thoughts and associations. According to the Satipatthana definition, sati operates in combination with clear knowing. The same presence of knowledge also underlies the expression he knows, which occurs frequently in the individual Satipatthana contemplations. Thus, to know or to contemplate clearly knowing can be taken to represent the conceptual input needed to taking clear cognizance of observed phenomena based on mindful observation. So he's pointing to the fact that we have to practice these ideas. But it's also important that we have the knowledge that we study, because it when something arises in our practice, we have in sense a theoretical context where it fits, where it's not like, oh my God, what the hell's that? Oh, I know what that is. Because I've studied and I've put, and it's those combination of the two together. And then here's this other thing Anileo says a little bit later on here. The fact that contemplation undertaken in this manner has the sole purpose of enhancing mindfulness and understanding points to the important shift away from goal-oriented practice. At this comparatively advanced stage, Satipatthana is practiced for its own sake. With this shift in attitude, the goal and the act of meditation begin to merge into one, since awareness and understanding are cultivated for the sake of developing even more awareness and understanding. The practice of Satipatthana becomes an effortless effort, so to speak, divested of goal orientation and expectation. This is something that my teachers talked of. I've been told this so many times, and so many times I catch myself in having goals and expectations. It's like, oh, it is precisely this way of contemplating that in turn enables one to proceed independently without clinging to anything in the world of experience, as stipulated in the final part of the refrain. In several discourses, the stipulation to abide without clinging to anything in the world occurs immediately before realization takes place. So this is the sort of the last step. Not clinging to anything. Joseph has something to say about this too. And this is actually, this is a story from the sutta that he tells a bit of the story, and then he actually quotes the sutta. So this recluse Bahaya heard that the Buddha could teach him something if he could just, you know, go and get some instruction, because he's been struggling practicing on his own and not really succeeding that well. Bahaya finally met the Buddha while the latter was going from house to house on alms rounds. Bahaya requested teaching right then and there. The Buddha replied that it was not an appropriate time and that Bahaya should come to see him at the monastery. But Bahaya requested teachings a second and then a third time. Three times is the magic number, right? Lord, you may die. I may die. Please teach me now. The Buddha, impressed with Bahaya's sincerity and urgency, then spoke these words. In the seen, there is only the seen. In the heard, there is only the heard. In the sensed, there is only the sensed. In the cognized, there is only the cognized. This, Bahaya, is how you train yourself. When, Bahaya, there is for you in the seen only the seen, in the heard only the heard, in the sensed only the sensed, in the cognized only the cognized, then, Bahaya, there is no you in connection with all that. When, Bahaya, there is no you in connection with that, there is no you there. When, Bahaya, there is no you there, then, Bahaya, you are neither here nor there, nor in between the two. This is the end of suffering. Just knowing there's no you there. It's the interesting thing about the story is then went and practiced and died the next day, but he died enlightened. Because they got those instructions, they put them immediately to use, and the Buddha had great praise for him. So like, he got it. So it's just a little extra tidbit to the story. I want to point out one interesting thing, and that's the fact that the refrain occurs after each set of instructions. This is something that's repeated over and over again. And this points to the idea that any one of these sets of instructions, completely understood and followed, can lead to enlightenment. Because that's what the refrain is saying. Keep, really pay attention in this way. This is the way to pay attention to these instructions and to implement them. Then you can end up abiding independent, not clinging to anything in the world. It's just that, oh, isn't that interesting? You know, I don't need all 13 sets of instructions. But it's like for people like me who I need more than one set of instructions, I get distracted too easily. That's why the Buddha gave 13, I think, for people like me. But I mean, there is like, mindfulness of breath. There's the whole thing, the Anapanasati Sutta, which is just mindfulness of breath. And in that sutta, the Buddha shows all the steps leading from just paying attention to the breath, just like in the Satipatthana Sutta to start with, it leads to enlightenment. But it's something we like, oh, isn't that interesting? That's sort of how I feel about that idea. It's just an interesting thought, I suppose, more than anything else. Of course, I have to finish with a little bit of poetry here. This is Dana Fals, and she's talking, I think, quite clearly about what the refrain is talking about in a sense. This poem is called Walk Slowly. It only takes a reminder to breathe, a moment to be still, and just like that, something in me settles, softens, makes space for imperfection. The harsh voice of judgment drops to a whisper, and I remember again that life isn't a relay race, that we will all cross the finish line, that waking up to life is what we were born for. As many times as I forget, catching myself charging forward without even knowing where I'm going, that many times I can make the choice to stop, to breathe, to be, and walk slowly into the mystery. That's what the Buddha is asking us to do, to walk slowly into the mystery. Walk like, keep heading, go in the right direction, keep moving, but don't rush. Walk slowly into the mystery. Let's dedicate the merit. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.